Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Thursday, February 12. The story, Trump turns to military leaders for high-stakes diplomacy. President Trump is increasingly turning to military leaders for some of his toughest diplomatic assignments, sending top brass to help negotiate the end of the Russia-Ukraine war, a potential new nuclear deal with Iran, and forge closer ties with countries in the Western Hemisphere. Army Secretary Daniel Driscoll, an Iraq War veteran and ally of Vice President Vance, has become the administration's top envoy to Ukraine as the U.S. seeks to broker peace with Russia. Admiral Brad Cooper, the commander of the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, joined talks in Oman last week for the first round of nuclear negotiations with Iranian officials, and General Dan Kane, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, traveled to Puerto Rico and Trinidad and Tobago in lead-up to the U.S. forces' raid on Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Normally, people who work in diplomacy a long time because it requires a certain amount of skill, tact, and patience. Larry Haas, a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the American Foreign Policy Council, said Tuesday in an interview with The Hill, "The skills that one acquires as a military leader are a bit different. It's more about directing than it is about negotiating, so it is unusual for presidents to rely on military leaders to do their diplomatic work." He said Trump appears less concerned about the credentials of his envoys to conduct diplomacy and more worried about choosing people he trusts. He will assume that the person, based on his relationship with them, will take general direction and get the job done, Haas said. It's an interesting phenomenon. Cooper sat alongside Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, a longtime associate of Trump, during his career in real estate, and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner in Muscat for a discussion regarding Iran's nuclear program. The administration has established a massive military presence near the Islamic Republic, dispatching the USS Abraham Lincoln, along with its three accompanying destroyers, fighter jets, and other military assets. Haas said the utility of Cooper's presence in Oman was twofold, sending a message to Tehran and tapping the admiral's deep knowledge of the region and Iran. "I don't think there's any question about that," he said. "I mean, this is in line with him sending the warships and the other weaponry and personnel to do to the region as a warning sign." Driscoll, who served in the Army for less than 4 years and earned the rank of first lieutenant, was thrust into the diplomatic sphere late last year when Trump sent him to present Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky with the 28-point proposal to end the Russia-Ukraine war, which has been raging for nearly 4 years. The Army Secretary's involvement in talks has continued this month, with participation in discussions in the United Arab Emirates. In Abu Dhabi, he was with General Alexis Grinkiewicz, commander of U.S. European Command, who announced the U.S. and Russia would resume high-level communication between their armed forces. Justin Logan, the director of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, said the Trump administration is trying to run a big foreign policy with a small team, and they're discovering it's hard. "Someone like Driscoll is an asset because he aligns with the president's foreign policy, and he's both competent and well-connected with the White House," Logan told The Hill. "Cooper being present at U.S. talks on Iran strikes me as somewhat more ordinary, particularly given the role that the threat of military force is playing in U.S. Middle East policy." Logan said Trump was clearly seeking a new personnel strategy in foreign affairs during his second term, but risked creating new roadblocks to achieving his ambitious goals. "The first term's foreign policy was ruined by a large team of people who worked to undermine the president's foreign policies," he said. "It's not much better to have a tiny team of loyalists who can't reasonably handle the workflow you're giving them." Secretary of State Marco Rubio is also Trump's national security advisor, the first to hold the double role since Henry Kissinger. Witkoff has taken on an ever-expanding role as a Trump global negotiator, with Vance and Rubio taking the lead on discussions over the future of America's relationship with Greenland, which Trump wants to control outright. Past presidents have at times entrusted unusual emissaries to conduct diplomacy. Former President Truman planned in 1948 to dispatch then U.S. Chief Justice Fred Vinson to Moscow to meet Joseph Stalin to hash out the Berlin crisis, but the effort fell through after hard opposition from then Secretary of State George Marshall. Former President Carter made an unauthorized trip to North Korea to meet with Kim Il-sung in 1994 during the Clinton administration to discuss the escalating nuclear crisis. The White House said Trump has an extraordinarily qualified national security team. Many countries have long-standing strong relationships with our men and women in uniform. Ultimately, the president is the deal-maker-in-chief and final decision-maker on any agreement, White House spokesperson Anna Kelly told The Hill in a statement on Wednesday. Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, met with Trinidad and Tobago Prime Minister Kamla Persid-Bessisar in late November last year, discussing strengthening ties in a joint effort to counter drug trafficking cartels in the region. Persad Bissessar played down reports that the U.S. was installing new military hardware at an airport on the island. Alyssa Ewers, who has served as a national security official in both Republican and Democratic administrations, argued the president's reliance on military leaders underscores the fact that the Trump administration devalues skilled diplomats and the tools of diplomacy, which often take a lot of time and hard work to show outcomes. The through line in these decisions is that the administration approaches complex negotiations, especially with adversaries, very differently. Ewers, who is now a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program and the Center for a New American Security, told The Hill on Wednesday. The White House did not respond to a request for comment from The Hill. The story: Democrats seek to weaponize Trump tariffs against GOP. Senate Republicans are staring down a major headache as Democrats ready constant votes targeting President Trump's tariffs, a political vulnerability given the unease many in the GOP feel about the import taxes. The Senate GOP will have to deal with this, with the issue, because the House GOP was unable to unify behind a rule that would have prevented the votes in the lower chamber. Three House Republicans on Tuesday night sided with Democrats on the matter, dealing a blow to the White House. The House on Wednesday night took the first of what is expected to be a series of these votes by disapproving of Trump's tariffs on Canada. More such votes are set to take place targeting tariffs on Mexico and Brazil. Due to the privileged nature of the House bills, the Senate will be forced to take them up if the lower chamber approves them. It has Democrats excited about opening a GOP wound. The thing about votes is everybody has to go on the record, said Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, and the Republicans who vote to continue to let Donald Trump play his on-again, off-again, up-down, enrich-himself, cut deals in the shadows games are going to have to live with those votes for a long, long time. It's hard to understand how Republicans in Congress continue to hold the line on Donald Trump's illegal tariff activities, she continued. It's time to put a stop to it. The Senate faced five similar votes last year, targeting Trump's tariffs against Canada, Brazil, and those issued on Liberation Day last spring. Four of them passed, but the measure affected the Liberation Day tariffs failed because of attendance issues. The pending votes represent a thorn in the side of the Senate GOP, many of whom are not fans of the president's tariff policy and view them as taxes that are passed down to American consumers. Some Republicans will not be thrilled to be defending them in the series of votes, which may become fodder for political commercials in the fall. We've already dealt with quite a few of them. It's a controversial subject, said Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, who has made no secret he is not the biggest fan of tariffs writ large. We have people in different camps on that issue, and I assume that'll continue to be the case, he said. If something comes over from the House, we'll deal with it when it does. In the coming weeks, the chamber will face a third vote of disapproval aimed at the president's tariffs against Canada, which have upset numerous members who have questioned the virtues of attacking one of the U.S.'s preeminent trade partners, Senators Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, and Rand Paul, Kentucky, Republican of Kentucky, backed both disapproval resolutions, which passed in April and October. On Wednesday evening in the House, six Republicans crossed party lines to back the Canada's disapproval measure, while Representative Jared Golden of Maine was the only Democrat to vote against it. The bill passed 219 to 211. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, who has led Democratic opposition to the tariffs, told local reporters on Wednesday he expects the upcoming measure to pass. We're now working in tandem with our House colleagues to strategize about how we can move together. We just think again and again and again we need to put these tariff votes before the body to reject President Trump's chaos, Kaine said. This is not a power that should be exercised by the president without congressional oversight. The votes are also taking place as lawmakers anxiously await a ruling by the Supreme Court on the president's authority to set broad tariffs. The justices are not set to meet in public again until late next week, meaning that is likely the earliest any ruling could come down. The court heard the case back in November, with administration officials pushing for an expeditious ruling, given the warning from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent that the longer a final ruling is delayed, the greater the risk of economic disruption. The pending result isn't changing the posture on Capitol Hill, though, with lawmakers continuing to argue the tariffs are unnecessary. Kaine specifically pointed to the president's claim that he levied a 39% tariff on Swiss goods after a conversation with the nation's former president, saying that he did not approve of the way she talked in the phone call. Again and again and again, I couldn't get her off the phone, Trump told Fox Business host Larry Kudlow on Tuesday. So the tariffs were at 30%, and I didn't really like the way she talked to us, and so instead of giving her a reduction, I raised it to 39%, and then I got inundated by people from Switzerland, and I figured, do you know what, we'll do something that's a little bit more palatable. Trump was likely referring to former Swiss President Karen Keller-Sutter, who departed office at the end of last year. Talk about chaotic and idiotic, Kaine said. Democrats and dissenting Republicans are also buoyed by poll numbers showing that Americans are against the continued policy. A recent survey by the Pew Research Center showed that 60% of respondents disapprove of the administration's increasing tariffs, including 39% who strongly disapprove. 37% backed the levies, with just 13% doing so strongly. Nevertheless, some key administration allies are hoping that tariff authority continues on for the White House. I welcome my Democrat colleagues' renewed interest in trade policy following 4 years of neglect under Biden, said Representative Adrian Smith, Republican of Nebraska, who chairs the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade. Trump has been clear he'll use every tool to advance his trade agenda. If Democrats were serious about real reform, they wouldn't hide behind procedural motions, he continued. It is time to work together to strengthen U.S. trade policy. The story: GOP senators express relief over failed DOJ effort to indict Democrats. Key Republican senators say a grand jury made the right decision by rejecting an effort by the Department of Justice, or DOJ, to indict six Democratic lawmakers, including Senators Mark Kelly of Arizona and Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, on criminal charges for filming a video last year urging military service members to disobey unlawful orders. Republican senators by and large agree the video urging members of the military and the nation's intelligence agencies to refuse unlawful orders was inappropriate because they thought it encouraged insubordination. But GOP lawmakers were surprised by the bombshell revelation Tuesday that Jeanine Pirro, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, had attempted to secure a criminal indictment against Kelly, Slotkin, and other Democrats, and they expressed relief that the aggressive move failed. I think the grand jury made the right decision, said Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, whose panel includes Kelly and Slotkin as members. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, a member of the Judiciary Committee, offered stronger words, applauding the grand jury's decision to reject what he called lawfare. He suggested the attempts to indict his Democratic colleagues were driven by politics after President Trump last year called for Kelly and Slotkin to be arrested and put on trial because of the video. Political lawfare waged by either side undermines America's criminal justice system, which is the gold standard of the world. Thankfully, in this instance, a jury saw that the attempted indictments for what they really were, Tillis said in a statement posted to social media. Political lawfare is not normal, not acceptable, and needs to stop, he warned. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, said federal prosecutors have better things to do than bringing charges against sitting U.S. senators over their political speech. I think that our law enforcement people ought to be spending their time on making our communities safe and going after real lawbreakers, he said. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said bringing criminal charges against sitting senators over the video was reckless and punitive. I'm glad that the grand jury came back and rejected indictments, but I think it is a very disturbing direction that the administration has taken in basically trying to make criminals out of sitting lawmakers who effectively pointed out what the Uniform Military Code of Justice says, she said. Asked about the grand jury's rejection of the charges, Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican of South Dakota, said the system worked the way it's supposed to. A Republican senator who requested anonymity said the attempt to bring criminal charges against Democratic lawmakers appeared to violate the Constitution's speech or debate clause. Article 1, Section 6, Clause 1 of the Constitution states federal lawmakers shall be privileged from arrest during their attendance of Congress or while traveling to or from the Capitol. There's the Constitution. It's called the Speech and Debate Clause. It trumps statute, the GOP lawmaker stated. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said he trusts the grand jury's judgment and predicted its rejection of the indictment should not or should put an end to attempts to criminally prosecute Democratic lawmakers. It looks like the grand jury came to their conclusion. I trust our judicial system. If that's the conclusion they arrived at, I think that pretty much lays things to rest as far as I'm concerned, he told reporters. Slotkin and Kelly told reporters Wednesday they only learned of the attempt by Pirro's office to indict them from the media and were never told what charges they potentially faced or what statute they allegedly violated. We literally are finding out from the media, and we have not been formally told what they were trying to charge us with and what law they were using, Slotkin said. She thanked Tillis for speaking out against the prosecution attempt. Kelly said he and his colleagues may never know what specific criminal charges the Justice Department tried to bring against them. With a grand jury, you do not get to present a legal defense. It's only the prosecutor and the jurors, and it's secret, he said. We don't ever expect to find out. The Arizona Democrat pointed out that it is very rare that a grand jury refuses to indict the target of a criminal prosecution, noting that in 2013, the most recent year for which he was able to obtain data, there were 165,000 indictments and only 5 were not successful. The process has a 99.997% success rate. Yes, I did the math, he quipped. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, called the attempt to bring criminal charges against Kelly, Slotkin, and other Democrats elected to Congress absolutely unprecedented and outrageous. He argued Democrats were exercising the right of free speech. It is very simply an effort to silence and intimidate public officials and everyday Americans who are critical of this administration. I think it is a perversion of justice, he said. Blumenthal, a former U.S. attorney and state attorney general, said the grand jury's rejection of the indictment was an embarrassment for the Trump Justice Department. For a grand jury to refuse the request for an indictment tells me that they had no evidence, no law, nothing on their side, he said. Slotkin told reporters Tuesday she thinks Pirro brought the prosecution against Democratic lawmakers because of pressure from Trump. This is not about real law. It's about weaponizing the Justice Department against people you disagree with, she said. The president vented his fury over the video that the Democrats circulated in November, urging military service members to refuse unlawful military orders, which came at a time when lawmakers in both parties were raising questions about the legality of the Trump administration's missile strikes against speedboats suspected of smuggling drugs from Venezuela. Trump accused the Democrats in a social media post of seditious behavior punishable by death. He also called them traitors, despite the fact that Kelly flew 39 combat missions over Iraq during Operation Desert Storm, and Slotkin worked for approximately 4 years as a CIA analyst focusing on the Middle East. The president's vehement reaction and over-the-top attacks left some Republican senators dumbfounded. If you take it at face value, the idea that calling your opponents traitors and then specifically saying that it warrants the death penalty is reckless, inappropriate, irresponsible, Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, told CBS's Face the Nation last year. Republican senators have also cautioned Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth against trying to punish Kelly, a retired Navy captain, by taking administrative steps to reduce the senator's military rank and pension. Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, who has jurisdiction over the Pentagon's budget, last month said it would not be appropriate to target Kelly's retired rank or pension because of his participation in the video. The story, why Maha wants the U.S. to be more like Denmark. In remaking U.S. vaccine policy, Health and Human Services, or HHS, Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his Make America Healthy Again, or Maha allies, have repeatedly called for the U.S. to emulate Denmark, confounding lawmakers and spurring criticism from public health experts. The Scandinavian nation of just 6 million people was the model for Kennedy's reduction in recommended childhood and adolescent vaccines from 17 to 11. Denmark recommends vaccines against 10 diseases, among the lowest of higher-income countries. Some experts theorize that Denmark's position as a vaccine outlier, despite a distinct lack of other similarities with the U.S., appealed to the Trump administration. The focus on Denmark is starting with the answer and then setting up the questions in a way that you land on Denmark as the answer, Gridar Malia, senior policy officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, told The Hill. On the surface, Denmark is an attractive country in terms of its public health outcomes. The country's life expectancy is a few years higher than that of the U.S.'s, and past polling has indicated people in the country have a higher level of trust in their public health authorities, all while recommending fewer vaccines and enforcing a far laxer approach to immunization. But as several critics have noted, Denmark simply isn't like America. The country has universal health care for its citizens, meaning the cost of drugs and procedures poses less of a burden for people seeking care. When you're a country of 6 million people, you have the ability to deploy a robust public health system to address outbreaks or to address specific population needs, because you know from your universal system who are the people that need care, Reginald Williams II, senior vice president of the Commonwealth Fund, told The Hill. And you have the public resources to then push people into addressing that very specific issue in a laser-targeted way that we simply just don't have in the U.S. In response to questions for the story, HHS did not specifically respond to criticism about using Denmark as a model, but said the U.S. previously recommended more than twice as many vaccines as some European nations. The updated CDC childhood schedule continues to protect children against serious diseases while aligning U.S. guidance with international norms, HHS spokesperson Emily Hilliard said. Many peer nations achieve high vaccination rates without mandates by relying on trust, education, and strong doctor-patient relationships, and HHS will work with states and clinicians to ensure families have clear, accurate information to make their own informed decisions. The administration's apparent fixation on Denmark has confounded members of Congress, with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle questioning why HHS is modeling its policies after the Scandinavian country. It was just strange to me that we're comparing ourselves to Denmark as a peer nation. Denmark has 6 million people. We have 340 million people from all walks of life. That's like 57 times larger, Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester, Democrat of Delaware, said during a Senate hearing last week while speaking with National Institutes of Health Director Jay Bhattacharya. Bhattacharya argued Denmark enjoys a stronger level of public trust in its rote public health systems, and that by recreating its policies in the U.S., trust might be restored domestically. But Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, decried this strategy as a crazy idea. The Louisiana senator is a strong proponent of vaccinations, with Kennedy's skepticism of immunizations being a constant point of contention between the two. If you're wealthy from Boston, you're going to have one experience, and if you're less wealthy, if you're poor from a rural town in Louisiana, you're going to have another, he said. Pounding his fists on the table, Cassidy said, if we pattern after the place that is wealthy, we're not meeting the needs of those that are poor. Kennedy and his allies argue that the U.S. was an outlier in terms of its vaccine policy, long recommending more childhood vaccines than most other countries. By modeling itself after Denmark, they say they're bringing the country in line with other peer nations. Malia acknowledged that the U.S. had a very comprehensive immunization schedule, but he said it wasn't an extreme outlier. I think when you compare us to nations in Western Europe, we were not significantly an outlier, Malia said. We did have one of the most comprehensive schedules because, one, it was very effective at preventing illness, preventing hospitalization, and preventing death, and two, it reflected the realities in our nation. Brazil and South Korea also recommend vaccines against 18 diseases, according to an analysis by STAT, while Canada, Spain, and Saudi Arabia recommend 16, and the UK, Germany, Italy, Israel, and Australia recommend 15. During a December meeting of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, Acting Director of the Food and Drug Administration's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, Tracy Beth Hoag, gave a presentation on the U.S.'s and Denmark's immunization schedules. Her presentation argued that the U.S. should avoid over-medicalizing childhood and that time in pediatricians' offices can be spent differently. But the European country is itself an outlier in how few vaccines it recommends, as the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota notes. Other Scandinavian countries, such as Sweden and Norway, recommend more vaccines than Denmark. Jake Scott, a clinical associate professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, said the selection of Denmark as a model for America's vaccine schedule was not the result of this rigorous policy analysis. I think it's because Denmark just has the most minimalist vaccine schedule in the developed world and no mandates. So if you're looking for a developed country to validate giving fewer vaccines, you know, Denmark makes sense, he said. The Hill reached out to some of the major outside groups aligned with Kennedy for this article, including Maha Action and Children's Health Defense, which he founded. They did not respond. Drawing public health policies from abroad is not unique to the Maha agenda. Progressive lawmakers such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, and Senator Bernie Sanders, Independent of Vermont, have long supported a Medicare for All system to be enacted in the U.S., often pointing to how other developed nations employ universal health care. According to policy experts such as Williams and Scott, the U.S. shouldn't seek to simply copy and paste other countries' policies writ large. I think a lot of times, when we get into conversations around what other countries are doing, we automatically think that it means kind of government-run health care at the national level, and that's simply not the case when you look around the globe, said Williams. You have to understand the systems, the basic systems, and structures of other countries' health care systems. The story, 2030 census, poses tough questions for Democrats' future. The population shifts projected for the next decade are raising questions about the impact they could have on Democrats' pathway to winning the White House and a House majority starting in 2032. 2030 population estimates released by the U.S. Census Bureau last month suggest a handful of Sun Belt states are expected to gain seats in the House, while some prominent Democratic-led states like New York and California are expected to lose seats. While experts emphasize the numbers are only estimates and don't account for potential political shifts, the population estimates suggest the party may have to grapple with how to become more competitive in Republican-held states like Texas and Florida. They have to expand the electoral battlefield from the traditional states that they have been most comfortable in campaigning in, and that means re-engaging in states like Texas and Florida, for starters, because you're going to see a greater number of electoral weight assigned to even those two states, said Miami-based Democratic pollster Fernand Amandi, who worked on former President Obama's presidential campaigns in Florida. They need to re-engage in that posture again, otherwise they're going to have a very difficult time recapturing the White House, he added. U.S. Census Bureau population estimates released last month have led experts to suggest Florida and Texas could gain a small handful of seats in the next decade. Several other Sun Belt states like Georgia and Arizona also could notch additional seats. California and New York are expected to lose a handful of seats. Other states like Pennsylvania, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Oregon are likely to lose a seat or two. Experts caution that there's only so much observers can read into the population estimates. For one, the numbers in different states obviously can change between now and 2030. Estimates also don't account for an ever-changing political landscape. The same states and voting blocks that trended red, blue, or purple may not remain that way by 2030. Things are sufficiently politically fluid for partisans right now that I sure wouldn't want to be making any bets as to which states are going to be red states and which states are going to be blue states 6 years from now, said Justin Levitt, a professor at Loyola Marymount University Loyola Law School, who closely tracks redistricting. Most importantly, a lot of this is predicated on how well the 2030 census is carried out. If states' populations aren't counted correctly, the ramifications for states are significant, including how many House seats states are apportioned for the upcoming decade. Red and blue states alike have an incentive for accurate counts. Still, the estimates offer some early clues and warning signs ahead of 2032. For Democrats, the expected population increases in Florida and Texas mean those states will only become more important for the party's electoral college math. Looking at the 2024 presidential election, Trump defeated Harris 312-226 in the electoral college, reaching and surpassing the 270 needed for a majority in victory, wrote Jeffrey Skelly, chief elections analyst for Decision Desk HQ, in a Substack post. The projected seat changes would have increased Trump's electoral vote haul to 322, a 10-vote increase. Monique Alcala, a former executive director for the Texas Democratic Party, suggests that if the party failed to act there, national Democrats are going to have no other choice but to piece together that puzzle outside of Texas. Alcala said that in order for Democrats to become more competitive in the Lone Star State, Democrats need a strong state party, a strong donor table, and strong campaign committees for the legislative chambers, with the task of recruiting high-quality candidates and building an apparatus that trains them in order to run professionalized races. The population estimates also offer a bit of a murky picture regarding the House majority. Paul Mitchell, a California Democratic redistricting expert, suggested one of the consequences could be the party losing a sizable number of seats in the Golden State for Democrats. The House majority would essentially take two hits out of California, one being the reapportionment and loss of congressional districts to other states, and the second being the reversion back to the commission-drawn map, which I 100% believe is going to be the lines that members of Congress are going to be running under in 2032, Mitchell said. A map drawn under the state's Independent Redistricting Commission would likely make the maps more competitive between the parties. While there are some signs that certain southern states like Florida are trending redder, the Florida GOP has made gains in its voter registration. It's not entirely clear how the population shifts will impact the political landscape in Republican-held states. Some Democrats believe there's a reason to be optimistic about the changing landscape in other states. When you look at places like Texas, which no one would dispute is growing, the most interesting information is that the communities of color are growing and the urban centers are growing, said John Bisignano, president of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee and its affiliates. It's not just generically that a red state, as one would call Texas, is growing. It's that, from my perspective, that state is purpling and changing, he added. The 2030 estimates come at a critical time for Democrats, who have overperformed in elections over the past year, while also navigating without a clear political leader. The progressive centrist battle within the party has only increased in recent months as the Democrats grapple with the direction of the party, particularly as calls for generational change have reverberated loudly and as both parties look toward a post-Trump political era. While the 2030 population estimates offered both warning signs and some reasons to be optimistic for Democrats, the full picture of the political landscape is still taking shape. I think what we may be looking at on the horizon is maybe a red wall where Democrats are going to have to break into the South or break into the Sun Belt states in order to win the White House, whereas Republicans may not need to win a Rust Belt state in order to carry the day, said Adam Kincaid, president of the National Republican Redistricting Trust. I don't think it means that either party is going to have a lock on the White House. I just think that it's going to change, he added. It'll just change our campaigns like apportionment always does. The story is The Hill's Morning Report. Trump's retribution campaign hits legal roadblocks. In today's issue, Bondi grilled over Epstein files. Lawmakers say DOJ tracked search history. Blanche tells U.S. attorney pick you are fired. El Paso airspace closure scrutiny shifts to lasers. President Trump's ongoing push to investigate various political opponents hit its latest obstacle this week when a grand jury declined to indict a half dozen Democratic members of Congress. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, led by Jeanine Pirro, sought to bring charges on Tuesday against six Democrats who participated in a video last fall reminding military service members they're allowed to disobey unlawful orders. The video didn't reference any specific conduct, but came as the administration was ramping up its campaign of striking alleged drug traffickers in the Caribbean. Trump slammed the Democrats after the video was posted, accusing them of engaging in seditious behavior and calling for them to be prosecuted. Soon after, the Pentagon launched efforts to demote Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, a retired Navy captain, for participating in the video. All of the members have military or intelligence backgrounds. Kelly and the other Democrats, Senator Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, and Representatives Jason Crow of Colorado, Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania, Chris DeLuzio of Pennsylvania, and Maggie Goodlander of New Hampshire, said last month they were under investigation by the Department of Justice, or DOJ, but federal prosecutors were ultimately unable to secure an indictment against them, reportedly on allegations of breaking a law forbidding interference with the U.S.'s military's loyalty, morale, or discipline. I'm a former prosecutor, and know a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich. Never seen a case where every grand juror refused to indict, Representative Ted Lieu, Democrat of California, posted. Shows case never should have been brought and is a vendetta against six veterans who spoke the truth. The forceful rejection by the grand jury is just the latest example of the administration's efforts to go after high-profile Democrats and other individuals being rebuffed in the courts. The first major instance came when a federal judge tossed out indictments against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James, Democrat. Those cases were dismissed on procedural grounds, as the judge found the president's hand-picked U.S. attorney who brought them, Lindsey Halligan, was improperly appointed to the role. But the DOJ has faced similar difficulty in trying to revive the cases, as two separate grand juries declined to re-indict James. It has instead turned to the appeals process to try to keep them alive. Halligan is also not the only person whose appointment as U.S. attorney has been tossed out by a federal judge. Others, such as Alina Haba, have also been forced to step aside over rulings against their appointments. Though there was a time where it seemed like a new Trump foe was indicted every week, the president's retribution agenda is largely stuck in limbo as the courts parse his efforts to prosecute his political adversaries, the Hill Courts reporter Ella Lee tells Morning Report. Investigations are ongoing into adversaries like the Federal Reserve's Lisa Cook and Jerome Powell and Congress's Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, but the Supreme Court's mulling of Trump's firing efforts at the Fed and a separate DOJ probe into Schiff's investigators has stopped those cases in their tracks, Lee adds. While the courts have pumped the brakes on Trump's efforts to go after his political foes, Lee noted that the administration is still charging ahead where opportunities arise, like with the six Democrats who filmed the video. Democrats are raising alarms about the succession of cases against Trump's opponents, particularly as the president hasn't been shy about openly calling for them to face charges. The Trump administration is trying to imprison their political opponents for informing service members of their rights. Americans stood up and said no, but we have to ask how much further will this administration go to silence free speech, Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, said in a post on the social platform X. Smart Take with Blake Berman. Six House Republicans join with Democrats to rebuke Trump on his trade stance toward Canada. The president responded by warning a primary challenge could be coming for those Republicans, saying they will suffer the consequences come election time. One of those Republicans is Representative Kevin Kiley of California. I read him Trump's post and asked if he's worried. I try not to look at things from that angle or to worry about that. I try to do the job that I was sent here to do, Kiley told me. I feel like I'm in touch with what the folks that I represent want, he added. The most significant moment for the tariffs comes soon as we await the Supreme Court's ruling on the president's signature economic policy. That's when Republicans will be forced to answer similar tariff-related questions, as they've now seen his latest primary threat. Three things to know today. The United States is in third place in the number of total medals won, with 12 a week into the Winter Olympics in Milan. Norway and Italy are tied for first with 13 each. The National Governors Association said its traditional bipartisan meeting is once again back on at the White House after invitations were provided to all members. The meeting had been briefly canceled over Trump's refusal to invite two Democratic governors. The Trump administration quickly moved to fire a new U.S. attorney just hours after he was appointed by federal judges in the Northern District of New York. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche wrote in a social media post directed to the appointee, Donald Kinsella, "You are fired." Leading the day, Bondi in hot seat, Attorney General Pam Bondi faced tough questions Wednesday about the DOJ's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files, engaging in often tense exchanges with lawmakers. One of the most combative moments came when Representative Premia Jayapal, Democrat of Washington, called on Bondi to turn around and apologize to survivors of Epstein's actions who were in the audience of the House Judiciary Committee hearing. The Democratic lawmaker asked the 11 survivors present to stand and raise their hand if they hadn't been able to meet with Trump's DOJ. All 11 stood and raised their hands. Jayapal and Bondi engaged in a shouting match in which the progressive lawmaker denounced the harm she and the DOJ has done, and the attorney general accused her of theatrics and being unprofessional. Bondi also sparred with other Democrats on the committee, including ranking member Jamie Raskin of Maryland and Representative Jerry Nadler of New York. She slammed Raskin as a washed-up loser lawyer. "You all should be apologizing. You sit here and you attack the president," she said. This administration released over 3 million pages of documents, over 3 million, and Donald Trump signed that law to release all of those documents. "He is the most transparent president in the nation's history," Bondi said. But those arguments haven't satisfied Democrats, who have pushed for greater transparency, especially after the DOJ allowed lawmakers to review the unredacted files. Some accuse the DOJ of improperly shielding names mentioned in the files in violation of the law. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, reposted a picture on X showing these survivors standing and raising their hands while Bondi looks forward. "A picture is worth a thousand words," he wrote. Tracked searches. Multiple lawmakers said the DOJ tracked which Epstein files they reviewed when looking through the unredacted documents at the department this week. Jayapal said in a post on X after the hearing with Bondi that the attorney general had with her a book with a printed search history of exactly what emails I searched. She slammed it as totally inappropriate and a violation of the separation of powers. "That is outrageous, and I intend to pursue this and stop this spying on members," she said. Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, joined Democrats in saying the DOJ is tracking which unredacted Epstein documents members of Congress open. She said there are timestamps associated with the tracking. MS Now reported that House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said the DOJ looking through Jayapal's search history would be inappropriate if it happened, but didn't want to comment further on the allegation. Representative Suha Subramanian, Democrat of Virginia, backed up Jayapal in a post on X, saying he saw it himself. "I was at the DOJ. That's exactly what happened," he said. On to the Senate. The pressure is on Senate Republicans after the House narrowly passed legislation to enact new voting requirements, but it faces an uncertain path forward. In the upper chamber, the House voted 218 to 213 on Wednesday to pass the Save America Act, which would require proof of citizenship to vote in elections and voters to present an ID to cast a ballot. Conservatives in the House and Senate have zeroed in on the bill to advance their election integrity push. Some Republicans have called for changing the Senate's filibuster rule to allow the bill to advance, as it would otherwise need Democratic votes to overcome the 60-vote threshold. But Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, has dismissed that idea, saying he personally opposes changing it and that the GOP doesn't have anywhere close to the votes necessary to do so. And at least one member of the Republican conference has already come out against the legislation, as Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska expressed concerns about adding sweeping new federal regulations on local election officials with just months before the midterms. She also cited the Constitution's empowerment of states to run elections. Still, conservatives are likely to keep up pressure on Thune to take action, The Hill's Emily Brooks reports. Tariff rebuke. Six House Republicans broke party lines to vote with nearly all Democrats for a resolution to repeal Trump's tariffs on Canada. The 219 to 211 vote is a blow to both the president and House Republican leadership, who were unable to gather enough votes to defeat the measure. GOP Representatives Don Bacon of Nebraska, Kevin Kiley of California, Thomas Massey of Kentucky, Jeff Hurd of Colorado, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, and Dan Newhouse of Washington voted in favor, while Representative Jared Golden of Maine was the only Democrat to vote against it. The resolution would declare an end to Trump's use of a national emergency to impose tariffs on Canada. It now goes to the Senate, where it seems likely to pass, with a few Republicans on record against the tariffs. The president will likely veto the measure, but the votes are symbolic rebuke of Trump's policy. It'll also open a door for Democrats to further press the administration on its tariff policy with a divided GOP. Trump lashed out against these six Republicans in a post on Truth Social, threatening to support primary challenges against them. Bacon and Newhouse aren't running for re-election, while Trump has already backed a challenger to Massey. End of an era. Political observers are lamenting Gallup's decision to no longer track presidential approval ratings after nearly nine decades of doing so. The company said Wednesday that it would cease publishing approval and favorability ratings of individual political figures this year, reflecting an evolution in how Gallup focuses its public research and thought leadership. It cited the sharp rise in the number of pollsters recording the president's approval rating, resulting in Gallup no longer charting its own path in doing so. Pollster Frank Luntz noted in a post on X that Gallup had been tracking approval ratings for every president since Franklin D. Roosevelt. Since then, the company has established a reputation as the premier firm for evaluating the public's view of the president. Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, called the decision a huge loss for journalists and those who follow politics. At Gallup has been the top source for presidential approval since FDR, and particularly valuable because of the historical context with apples-to-apples numbers that allow us to make comparisons and see patterns, he said in a post on X. Gallup first surveyed the public on their view of the president in 1938 and has consistently asked respondents whether they approve or disapprove of the president's job performance since Harry Truman's presidency, and has regularly been one of the most cited trackers of presidential approval ratings among media outlets. Trump's approval rating reached its lowest point of his second term during Gallup's most recent approval poll in November, falling to 36%. Mixed report. The latest jobs report released Wednesday paints a mixed picture of the economy, which exceeded expectations last month, but gained far fewer jobs than originally reported last year. Data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, showed the economy added 130,000 jobs in January, considerably higher than the 70,000 economists expected. The unemployment rate ticked down to 4.3%. But BLS also lowered the number of jobs gained in 2025 by 400,000, showing the economy only gained 181,000 during the year. The preliminary revision of jobs data is part of a standard annual process in which the agency recalculates employment data based on new information on the U.S. population. In the where and when, the president will receive an intelligence briefing at 11 a.m. He will make an announcement along with Environmental Protection Agency head Lee Zeldin at 1:30 p.m. He will participate in policy meetings at 3 p.m. and 5:30 p.m. The House will convene at 9 a.m. The Senate will meet at 11 a.m. Census concerns. The most recent projections for the 2030 census could spell trouble for Democrats' strategy to win the White House and a majority in the House with expected population shifts. The population estimates released by the U.S. Census Bureau last month indicate a handful of states in the Sun Belt are expected to gain seats in the House, while prominent Democratic-leaning states, such as New York and Canada, are expected to lose seats. These numbers aren't set in stone and don't account for possible political shifts, but they might indicate Democrats will need to compete in more difficult terrain in the next decade, the Hill's Caroline Vakil reports. Miami-based Democratic pollster Fernand Amandi said Democrats need to be able to re-engage in states such as Texas and Florida. They need to re-engage in that posture again, otherwise they're going to have a very difficult time recapturing the White House, he told Vakil. Still, observers should be cautious about how much they take away from these numbers, experts say. The next census is still a few years away, and the numbers can change significantly. States also often don't remain stagnant as red, blue, or purple stay areas, providing opportunities for both parties. But the projections do offer some warning signs for Democrats as they think ahead to the 2032 elections. Elsewhere, El Paso chaos. An anti-drone laser technology test was responsible for the brief closure of airspace around El Paso, Texas, and in southern New Mexico on Wednesday, multiple outlets reported. the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, imposed a 10-day stoppage early Wednesday morning on flights into and out of El Paso International Airport and the Dona Ana County International Jetport near Santa Teresa, New Mexico. But the agency reversed course hours later, lifting all restrictions. The order quickly caused confusion, as local and other federal officials said they weren't notified ahead of the decision. Conflicting explanations have been given for what caused the brief disruption. A Trump administration official told The Hill and other outlets that the closure was a result of Mexican cartel drones breaching U.S. airspace. They said the Pentagon took action to disable the drones and determined with the FBA, the FAA, that no threat to commercial travel existed. But multiple outlets reported the incident occurred when Customs and Border Protection officials used the laser on loan from the Pentagon without giving the FAA enough time to evaluate potential harms to commercial air travel. The laser was reportedly deployed near Fort Bliss, a U.S. Army base near El Paso. CBS News reported FAA Administrator Brian Bedford decided to close the airspace without telling the White House, Pentagon, or Department of Homeland Security. Bedford intended for the restrictions to be in place to ensure safety. But the decision was discussed in a meeting at White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles' office, and the FAA lifted the restrictions minutes later, CBS reported. And finally, it's Thursday, which means it's time for the weekly news quiz. This weekend is President's Day weekend, a moment to honor those who have served this country. So this will accordingly be a classic quiz about the holiday, its history, and the people it honors. Be sure to email your responses to jgans@thehill.com. Please add quiz to your subject line. Winners who submit correct answers will receive deserved newsletter fame on Friday. What is the earliest and latest the holiday can fall on, respectively? February 12 and February 22, February 13 and February 21, February 14 and February 22, February 15 and February 21. When was it declared a national holiday? 1800, 1879, 1908, or 1935? What is the formal official name of the holiday by the federal government? President's Day, President's Day, Washington's birthday, or Lincoln's birthday? Which president has the most national parks named in his honor? George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, or Theodore Roosevelt? The story, Dawson's Creek star James Vanderbeek dies at 48. James Vanderbeek, the hit star from Dawson's Creek, died to colorectal cancer on Wednesday. He was 48 years old. Our beloved James David Vanderbeek passed peacefully this morning. He met his final days with courage, faith, and grace, his family wrote in a statement on Instagram. There is much to share regarding his wishes, love for humanity, and the sacredness of time. Those days will come. For now, we ask for peaceful privacy as we grieve our loving husband, father, son, brother, and friend, they added. Vanderbeek was first diagnosed in August 2023, according to Today. I've been privately dealing with this diagnosis and have been taking steps to resolve it with the support of my incredible family, the critically acclaimed actor told People in 2024. There's reason for optimism and I'm feeling good, he added. Vanderbeek was well known for his role in the hit Dawson's Creek series where teens explored the realities of friendship and love. He landed several award-winning roles after the show, including the 1999 film Varsity Blues, for which he won an MTV Movie Award for Best Breakthrough Male Performance, and a 2001 appearance in Scary Movie, which earned him an MTV Movie Award for Best Cameo in a Movie. Later down the line, Vanderbeek joined the 28th season of Dancing with the Stars with partner Emma Slater. The duo became semifinalists and fan favorites.